You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The conflict in Yemen has escalated dramatically, with the Associated Press reporting last Thursday that an estimated 519 people have been killed in the previous 2 weeks alone, 90 of them children. The uprising began when Shiite rebels, known as Houthis, tried to grab power from President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi's beleaguered government. Saudi Arabia and its allies began airstrikes in late March, which has only served to intensify the conflict. Safa al-Ahmed, a Saudi journalist, film director, and cinematographer, explores this complex and tragic conflict in a special report called The Fight for Yemen. It's part of the PBS Frontline series presented in conjunction with BBC Arabic, and it airs on Channel 13 here in New York tomorrow night at 10. I'm very pleased to welcome Safa al-Ahmed to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The statistics on Yemen even before this recent conflict are shocking. The United Nations reports that, quote, more than one-half the population of 25 million lives in poverty. Water resources are dwindling. The country has one of the highest rates of child malnutrition in the world. The country is also already dealing with some 330,000 displaced people, Yemenis who fled their homes in previous conflicts. How long did the previous conflict last?
If we're talking about the wars on Saada in the north, then they started in 2004 and continued successive six wars until 2010, end of 2009.
Does this current situation have any connection to that?
Absolutely. I mean, the Houthis come from the north of Yemen, Saada, where these wars happened. And Ali Saleh, the then president at the time, waged war on the founder of the Houthi movement, Hussein al-Houthi. This is where the name comes from. And so from 2004, where the Yemeni army managed to kill Hussein al-Houthi, but they continued. And six wars right after the other happened because Ali Saleh had failed to eradicate the Houthis, and the Houthis just kept getting stronger.
Is this similar to the situations we've seen in other countries where there are strong tensions between the Sunnis and the Shiites? In this case, Yemen, the Sunnis are majority, aren't they?
Yeah, no. What's happening in Yemen is not like the rest of if you're referring to Iraq, for example, or Syria in that way. I would argue that all these conflicts start as political, and then sectarian language is used to justify, to continue it, to polarize people. But specifically in Yemen, Saada, as you just mentioned, that Yemen is one of the poorest Arab countries with massive underdevelopment issues. And Saada was one of the worst in those underdeveloped areas. And so they were already very marginalized, and they weren't a militia to start off. But the war that Ali started on Saada and on Hussein al-Houthi and his men has turned them into such. It's quite problematic and sad, because with all these conflicts, they always start off with the marginalized, with the oppressed, with people who have political issues with the governments, and yet they become something very different and very sectarian and ugly. And what we're looking at now in Yemen is potentially civil war because of this as well. But I wouldn't say that this is a Sunni-Shia conflict specifically in Yemen, because the Houthis are Zaydi. They're an offshoot of Shia Islam, but they're very different than the Shia in Iran, for example. Their beliefs are very different in that way. They're closer to Sunnis in that way, ironically, than they are to the Shia. And so it's not beneficial to see the conflict in Yemen in that way. It has become such now because people are using it to polarize and to galvanize their bases. But initially, it wasn't like that at all.
Well, the Houthis claim in the film that their goal is to end sectarian violence. They say their movement is beyond borders. Mm-hmm. It's about the whole Islamic world.
Yes.
And then you show them replacing all the Sunni imams with Shiite imams.
Yes. Yeah.
So that does seem to go against that claim.
Absolutely. I mean, their slogan, which is God is great, death to America, death to Israel, God curse the Jews, victory to Islam. They told me that shows that they're not sectarian, that they want to unify Muslims against who they see are the real threat. which is the imperialist Americans and Israelis, and the whole conspiracy theory around the Jews. So there's a lot of anti-Semitism in that as well. And so, but their actions belie that as well, because their behavior towards the populations. So anybody who is against them is called Daeshi, and Daesh is the Arabic acronym for ISIS. Hmm. And so they, even before there was ISIS in Yemen, that was the kind of language they used against Al-Qaeda and against the Muslim Brotherhood. So they just brushed everyone with that wide brush of ISIS. And so, yes, they didn't help the situation by using this kind of language. But also Al-Qaeda has used that language of, oh, there was a Shia enemy, referring to the Houthis. So both sides have used that kind of sectarian language to describe each other.
Well, the slogans that you quoted, God is great, debt to America, debt to Israel, God curse the Jews, victory to Islam, those are the slogans of the Iranian Revolution, aren't
That's
they?
That's where it came from, yes.
So that would also suggest a we'll get into the whole business of just how much Iran is implicated in all of this, but the Hadi government was made up largely of members of the Muslim Brotherhood. So are either of these groups any better from an American perspective?
Well, I don't know about an American perspective, but from the Yemeni perspective, and after the revolution in 2011, there was a lot of hope that a better political system would be created. The Muslim Brotherhood did come out as victors after the revolution, but unfortunately they've proven to be just as corrupt as Ali Saleh and all the other political groups as well. So when the Houthis came in with this whole idea of we're anti-corruption, we're going to fight these things, a lot of people really wanted to believe in that. I mean, if you're talking about the American perspective, then the Houthis are the most dedicated anti-Qaeda fighters you have on the ground in Yemen. They were more functional than the anti-terrorism unit that the Americans have spent millions, if not billions, training and arming. I mean, the Americans have just fled the military base and left over $500 million worth of weapons. So when it comes to what is the benefit of America, I don't think constructive to look at it purely from an anti-terrorism point of view, because that kind of tunnel vision is what got the Americans into the situation they're in now, I think.
Well, they do say death to America, death to Israel. Yes. But it was recently reported that the escalation in violence has led countries such as Russia and Turkey to evacuate their citizens. The U.S.
hasn't. And the Chinese and the Indians, I mean.
But the United States hasn't, although the embassy personnel were evacuated on February 11th. Our government has merely issued a travel warning and advised Americans to leave on their own.
Yes.
Al Jazeera and The Guardian spoke to a number of Yemeni Americans who wonder why the United States is hesitating to follow all those other countries' lead, despite having three naval ships in nearby waters.
It's a good question for the Americans. I don't know why. I mean, there is an air and sea embargo. How do you think that American citizens are going to evacuate themselves? I mean, by begging other countries who have taken out their citizens to take them? I mean, I really don't understand. I think the Americans are in a really precarious situation right now, where they find their allies and enemies all in the same place. I don't envy them. It's a really complex situation in Yemen right now.
My guest is Safa Al-Ahmad, a Saudi journalist, director, and cinematographer. She made a film called Saudi Secret Uprising last year, and now she gives us The Fight for Yemen for the PBS Frontline series. When did you begin filming for this documentary?
I started pitching this documentary in early September, even before the Houthis had entered Sana'a. I've been following the Houthis for a while, and I've known several of them throughout the years. And I've been trying to
They're not suspicious of you because you're a Saudi?
That was something to overcome. The Houthis are suspicious of media in general. They believe they've had a bad shake with the media in general, especially with the media blackout that accompanied the wars on Saada, and such little coverage has actually come out from those. So they're very suspicious. But also, as any militia, they're always very suspicious and they don't like to be filmed. And so it was a combination of a lot of these things. What helped is I already had personal connections with them before. I had been trying to go to Sa'adah for years before that. And so they kind of knew that I was interested in the story even before they became this big power in Sana'a. But even then, it was very careful negotiations. And every step of the way, it was very difficult to maneuver. Like even with the scene in the mosque where they were trying to take my camera, that was way in the beginning of filming. That was one of my first weeks there. And so it was always an extremely delicate process to get them to open up. For example, the popular committees, not the revolutionary committees that I went with to the ministries, but the popular committees are the ones who are responsible for the security, the checkpoints and all that inside the city. I still didn't get access to them the way I wanted. And it was after months and months of begging, and they still wouldn't do it. So,
does it help that you're pretty much a one-person show, that you are the cinematographer and the director and the journalist reporting the story?
Actually, no. They were more suspicious. They were like, what, it's just you? I mean, they weren't very impressed with my one-man show. they were expecting huge cameras and a big crew and all that. But they soon realized that what I was trying to tell them is that you are now the power on the ground, and you should tell people who you are. And so after a lot of talking and explaining about what is a documentary, because people are more used to news packages, so they're used to, like, the shorter things. And so I had to show them a lot of my other work and show them what it means to have a documentary and expanding on that and the context and all that. But it still took a lot of convincing.
One of the things that really pops out during your film is that you're usually the only woman in the room. Mm. What was it like when you visited Al-Qaeda or when you sat in while the Minister of Finance and the Houthis were negotiating?
I get asked that a lot. Yemen has no problem with women, and it is so much easier for me to work in Yemen than it is, for example, in Saudi Arabia. I had a much easier time.
You could drive your own car?
I don't drive, but I could if I wanted to. That's remnants of being Saudi. I never got to learn how to drive. But the whole thing about being a woman to me is an asset. People are more likely to open up and talk to you. You get access to places where maybe a man would have more difficulty in accessing. So to me, I've never had a problem in Yemen because I was a woman. The problems I got were because I'm a journalist, because of the camera. People are really suspicious of journalists, and so that was more the challenge. My gender is not an issue.
We'll take a little break and come back with War. My guest is Safa Al-Ahmed, a Saudi journalist, director, cinematographer. Her special report for PBS's Frontline series, presented in conjunction with BBC Arabic, is The Fight for Yemen, and it will be broadcast tomorrow here in New York at 10 p.m. Stay with us for more. We are back with Safa Al-Ahmed, Saudi journalist, director, and cinematographer. Her special report for PBS is called The Fight for Yemen, and it is presented in conjunction with BBC Arabic. It airs tomorrow night at 10 here in New York. Now, the situation is so fluid. How much has changed since you finished making this?
A lot has changed. The airstrikes, for one, very obvious, changed. Also, when I was there, President Hadi at the time was still in Sana'a. After I left, they had declared the new constitution, and they put President Hadi and the rest of the government under house arrest. He later fled Sana'a. And went to Aden, and in Aden, after the attacks and the Houthis coming into Aden, he fled again, and went to, now is in Saudi. So a lot of stuff has changed on the ground, much worse than I thought could possibly happen in Yemen.
Has the capital been functioning more or less the same under Houthi control?
It is. I mean, what they did was lay hands on the government institutions, right? So in the film, when you see us walking into the Ministry of Finance, one of the big things for them was to have control, but little responsibility. They wanted to continue to have a government that would listen to them and do everything they wanted, but they didn't want to be directly responsible.
So they left a lot of the bureaucracy in place.
Absolutely, because, I mean, the bureaucracy is not something they were interested in. They just wanted the control, the power, the money. And so they weren't interested in the day-to-day running of the government. And so they allowed that to continue. But they were more interested in the bigger fish in the government.
Weren't they able to take the capital in just 4 days?
Yeah.
Was the Yemeni army that weak, or were the Houthis that strong?
I think it shows more the fragmentation of the army itself and the alliance that the Houthis had struck with Ali Saleh, the previous president, that ironically had waged the 6 wars against them. So that had allowed them to build big alliances with a lot of people. So the only ones left were Ali Mehsen, who was head of the 1st Brigade, who is also seen as Muslim Brotherhood. And so it just goes to show you how clever the Houthis were and how wide their alliances had become before they walked into Sana'a. I mean, there are a lot of people who joined them inside Sana'a itself as well. So we cannot claim that the Houthis have come as an occupier into a city. They already had allies within the city, and they are Yemeni. They, you know, a lot of them were from Sana'a as well. So it's not like an occupying army in that sense. Mm-hmm. But they definitely laid their hands on a government that did not have control of before.
There have been claims that Iran is backing the Houthis with cash and arms, but mm-hmm. several Houthis deny those claims in your film. Mm-hmm. What evidence is there that Iran may be involved? And if not Iran, who is supplying them?
Well, when it comes to arms, Yemen is notorious for having a lot of arms. Everybody's armed. The whole question of how involved Iran is with the Houthis needs a complete separate, really intensive investigation. I have found evidence of that relationship, but I think it's vastly overplayed. If you're talking about how strong presence the Saudis have inside Yemen, the huge border that they share with Yemen. The Saudis have much deeper roots and involvement in Yemen than the Iranians ever did. And I wouldn't consider that the Houthis are puppets for the Iranians either. I don't think that it's that kind of relationship. The Houthis derive their power and the weaknesses, if you want, from local issues, from local conflicts. The other thing, if I may say, the whole thing of conflating the sectarian, because the Houthis are Shia and the Iranians are Shia, I think that's not the correct way to view that relationship. I mean, Hamas has a close relationship with Iran. Doesn't mean that Hamas are Shia. They just have political alliances. And the Houthis fall within that category of political alliances with Iran.
But what the Saudis see this as Yemen, because of its strategic position as a country that they really have a major stake in? Is mm-hmm. that why they've been funding the Houthi loyalists and mm-hmm. Other Sunnis, and then, of course, they've initiated this bombing campaign?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, the Saudis have been involved for better or for worse in Yemen. I mean, they've also put in millions to stabilize the Yemeni currency. They have had a positive effect financially on in Yemen as well. But they also have had a detrimental effect. I mean, like the airstrikes now. So the relationship has always been a very contentious one between the Saudis and the Yemenis.
Of course, Osama bin Laden was Yemeni.
Saudi.
His his family moved to Saudi Arabia, so there's those kinds of connections as well. Mm. What is the bombing campaign hoping to do? Are they bombing Sana'a?
You'll have to ask the Saudis. I don't think airstrikes, regardless who does them and who's the victim, rarely do the result produce the results they claim they want. Like the drone strikes the Americans had for years on Yemen, they never managed to eradicate Al Qaeda, nor are the Saudi strikes going to eradicate the Houthis. So that is a problematic premise, in my opinion. But also when they say they want to restore the legitimate president and the government, namely Hadi in Yemen, I don't know of any Yemenis that want him to return. A lot of people see him as a failure. He's failed on so many levels as a president. So I don't know what they hope to actually concretely achieve with these airstrikes.
Well, there was the corruption problem, as you said. One of the Houthi campaigns has been against corruption, and that tapped into existing sentiment about the Hadi government. But the Houthis have a Revolutionary Legal Committee, and they go to visit the Minister of Finance in your film. They won't leave until he agrees to sign off on an investigation into missing funds from the government. What's the relationship like between the leftover bureaucrats of Hadi's government and the Houthis? And how much money actually has gone missing?
Yeah, actually, just to tie it back to the Saudis, they were investigating money that the Saudis had given a grant, $2 billion in oil, and to help out the Yemenis. And so all of that went missing, the Houthis say. And so it's... I mean, this whole thing about the corruption and the Houthis, it's if they had actually delivered on that promise, I think a lot of Yemenis would have been in a better state. But what's happening now is something quite devastating. It's quite astounding what's happening now.
Well, have the Houthis really gone after corruption, or are they likely to just bring in their own form of corruption?
I would argue they didn't and they won't. And they've established a lot of people that were known to be corrupt, and their own behavior after they took control of the government it does not indicate that they're actually fighting corruption, but rather using and abusing those institutions for their own benefit. And there are plenty of cases that have been proven that way. And I mean, misplacing or using things for their own celebrations and stuff like that, enforcing municipalities to pay millions of Yemeni rials for it when people are dying of malnutrition. I think their priorities are quite skewed.
My guest is Safa Al-Ahmed, whose special report for PBS's Frontline series is The Fight for Yemen. It will be broadcast tomorrow night at 10. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the film, you actually enter a town controlled by al-Qaeda. How did you get that kind of access?
You were talking about Ngaifa.
Yeah.
Well,
you've been reporting on al-Qaeda and their activities for Frontline for a while now, haven't you? 2012?
Yeah. I did a film in 2012 called Al-Qaeda in Yemen when Al-Qaeda had actually controlled large parts of South Yemen. So we went to towns like Ja'ar and Azan where they had declared an Islamic emirate even before ISIS existed. It was really interesting. I mean, all these militias that I've spoken to in Yemen, it goes back to the same thing of the failure of the state opens up the chance for militias to take control. And like when I went to visit Al-Qaeda, they had a functional city. They were bringing water and electricity and sewage. I mean, there was a village that hadn't had electricity in 20 years, and they had brought in this Iraqi engineer from Al-Qaeda to come back and bring electricity to this village. And it's just like, this wouldn't have been possible if there was a functional Yemeni government. Then these people who don't care who's bringing back water and electricity to their area, they don't care who is Al-Qaeda, right? It's not their fight. Yet they are now being attacked with drones because Al-Qaeda is there. Yet to them, they are the ones who have a functional state. They had courts that weren't corrupt. They solved cases that were stuck for 15 years or more. And so there you see how the different militias play into the desperation of the people to have a real country, right? And it's so sad because it's, I mean, with all American money and the billions going into the anti-terrorism thing, all they needed to do was build roads, provide water, electricity, schools, hospitals. That would have made a difference.
And the United States began giving cash and arms to the Yemeni government to fight al-Qaeda after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most shocking facts exposed in the film is the widespread use of children in this conflict.
Yeah.
Is it just al-Qaeda that's using the children?
No. All sides. All sides use them. And even the army itself uses them. Poor families will give their children to the army or these militias because that's the way of making money. And it goes back to the whole question of poverty in Yemen and the lack of institutions that can protect them. And that's the major problem. So it's not that the Al-Qaeda uses them or the Houthi use them. It's that there is no state for these people to protect themselves by being embraced by this institution, right? And so you can't blame those families for letting their children fight in these wars. Everybody's trying to survive.
But at one point, you visit a bomb-making factory, and there are explosive belts made in sizes suitable for children.
Right.
So these are children who are going to go on suicide missions. The fact that 90 children have died in the last 2 weeks or so, mm-hmm. I guess more by now, does that mean that they were used in the conflict or are they just innocents caught up in the bombing?
Within these strikes, I would say they were caught up in the bombing.
And there, we mentioned, of course, the Saudi airstrikes, but the United States has been using drones mm-hmm. in the al-Qaeda-controlled territory for a while now.
Yes. Yes, and they've killed a lot of civilians as well. And that has galvanized more people to stand with al-Qaeda because they see them as victims of American attacks and imperialism. And so I don't know what the Americans were hoping to do, but the drone policy to me has backlashed.
Al-Qaeda actually quotes President George W. Bush in saying, "You're either with us or against us."
Yes.
Using our words against us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that was the spokesperson for al-Qaeda that was with us that said that. And he meant it. So you either stand with their agenda or you're against them. And so the space for disagreement has shrunk considerably.
There have also been calls for prisoner exchanges. How effective have they been?
I think with those, when we're talking about the soldiers who were kidnapped by al-Qaeda during their attacks, mm-hmm. Those have succeeded. I mean, al-Qaeda has succeeded mostly in negotiating those kinds of exchanges.
Saudi Arabia in 2009 was concerned about the growth of the Houthis, and they decided to join the Yemeni army in attacking them.
Mm-hmm.
What tactics were they using then?
Mostly aerial bombardment, like they are doing now. As per my knowledge, although that conflict was really badly covered, they had bombed a lot of villages and especially around the border area. And they've evacuated so many villages that were on that border on the Saudi side as well. And they considered it a no man's land between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. The border is not well defined. So you can walk in and out of what you think is Yemen and Saudi Arabia quite easily.
And don't some Yemenis believe that some of the land that the Saudis claim is actually theirs?
The border agreements between Yemen and Saudi Arabia for some Yemenis was contentious of why Ali Saleh signed those agreements with the Saudis. But in general, I would say that the borders in the Arabian Peninsula in general, like there have been disagreements between Qatar and Saudi Arabia or Bahrain and Qatar. I mean, the longest dispute in international court was between Qatar and Bahrain to draw the border between them. So they're not unique in that way. The disagreements on borders is within the region.
Yemen, should we be paying more attention to Yemen because of
absolutely
its geographic situation?
I think you should be paying attention to Yemen regardless.
But we do ignore – if Yemen had oil, I suspect we'd be paying a bit more attention. They say the same about Congo where
yes.
so many people have died in conflicts there.
Yeah, yeah, that's another amazing conflict. It's quite heartbreaking how little comes out of Congo as well. But to me, on a personal level, I find Yemen fascinating. I mean, it's just one of those countries you come in with questions and you leave with more questions than answers. It's just such a complex, beautiful country. And it's such a historically important area for the entire region. I mean, the origin of all Arabs comes from Yemen. The Queen of Sheba allegedly was in Yemen. So, there's so much history. The British controlled Aden in south of Yemen. I mean, there's so much interest that people can have in Yemen in general, not just the wars. Sadly, if it bleeds, it leads in media. But I would argue, especially within the prism of Americans insisting on a foreign policy that is led by anti-terrorism, it is very detrimental to the area, and there is direct impact on the people on the ground because of these kind of policies. Because if the Americans continue to fund and arm dictatorships in these countries where they know they are corrupt, when they know they don't believe in human rights, when they know all these things and they continue to support them, then they shouldn't be surprised that militias will come and try to overthrow them, and that will use the same language of violence. And so we shouldn't be surprised when these things happen. And Americans should acknowledge their role in this.
Well, some people say they're victims of violence by both the Houthis and the various Sunni terrorist groups.
Absolutely.
Are there any
Absolutely.
Good guys here?
I mean, the good guys are the people who started the revolution in 2011, the youth and the NGOs and the civil society and the women and all those voices that called for reform, real reform. What the great powers, quote unquote, the Americans, the UN, Saudi Arabia and the GCC, all those people, in my opinion, have failed the Yemeni people in delivering that when they gave carte blanche immunity to Ali Saleh, the strong man that had been in control of Yemen for 30 years. When they don't, when they stop real reform from happening, I mean, the whole thing with Saada has been brewing for a long time, and they refuse to deal with it. The secessionists in the south, it's another problem that they refuse to deal with it. Now, both of them are blowing up on their faces. And so all the people that could have been the civil, democratic, beautiful voice of Yemen has been crushed. And this is what we end up with. So the Americans and the United Nations specifically should not be surprised that this is happening, because they knew quite well, step by step from 2011, that this is what they were doing. They were alienating those civil, peaceful, democratic voices on the ground.
But Safa, none of the Arab Spring rebellions have turned out the way the people who were rising up would have liked.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean,
this when you talk. This is not unique to Yemen.
No, and this is part of the problem. When dictatorships who've been there for forever refuse to let go of power, like with Bashar al-Assad in Syria, for example, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that they are going to deal with peaceful protests, at least initially, with violence. And so nobody's surprised by that. I mean, the whole problem with these dictatorships, when they don't leave room for civil society, when there is no room for people to grow as political organizations, then they will resort to violence as well when they're put in a corner. And that is a lesson that we need to learn about how these things happen. So the Americans, when they're supporting these dictatorships, and it's not, yes, you're right, it's not just Yemen. It's Hosni Mubarak in Egypt or in Syria or in Iraq. They didn't suddenly become dictatorships. They were dictatorships for decades.
The Fight for Yemen will be broadcast tomorrow night on Channel 13 here in New York at 10 o'clock. It is a joint effort from PBS Frontline and BBC Arabic. My great thanks to Safa Al-Ahmad, Saudi journalist, film director, and cinematographer, the person behind this report, for being on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.